Good afternoon, Regent Radio. This is Omaysa Marahemtula, and I'm joined on the line by Dr. Gerald Horn. Hello, Dr. Horn. How are you today?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you. And yourself?
Not too bad. Thank you. Just to remind our listeners that today is actually Tuesday afternoon, so not even the regular Wednesday. We're maybe 4 days behind, but still relevant. So I wanted to start off by, the breaking news, but not shocking news, that South African President Jacob Zuma and Cyril Ramaphosa were elected president and vice president of the African National Congress just a few hours ago.
That is correct. And there was some opposition to Mr. Zuma, but as listeners to Regent Radio well know, he has a formidable basis of support, not least in KwaZulu-Natal, which is the region of South Africa surrounding Durban, the Indian Ocean port city. And despite the fact that he's involved in various transgressions of various natures, not least financial, the Mail and Guardian of South Africa has reported about his curious relationships with affluent businessmen, the delegates saw fit to overlook that. In the interest of continuity and stability, I would assume. However, there were a few shadows over this meeting. You may have noted that a group of right-wing extremist white supremacists sought to blow up, literally, the ANC confab and murder in cold blood the leadership of the African National Congress and the state of South Africa, with Jacob Zuma being high on their list. They have been arrested and detained, and we shall see what the trial of these miscreants brings to the surface. I have to confess that the publicity, negative publicity surrounding Jacob Zuma, has been so pervasive. It's made me wonder. You know, I've been critical of Jacob Zuma, and I'm sure many listeners to Regent Radio have been critical of Jacob Zuma as well. But the criticism from the mainstream press, I have to say, gives me pause, and I'm going to have to think about that a bit more deeply. I'm also going to have to think about more deeply the election of his deputy, Cyril Ramaphosa, one of the richest men of African descent in the world today. Although this billionaire started out rather humbly, he was a lawyer. He was an organizer for the Mine Workers Union in South Africa in the 1980s and led and coordinated some of their most important strikes during that time. He was a negotiator in the early 1990s of the post-apartheid dispensation. It has been reported that Nelson Mandela favored him as a successor, but as is well known, he was pipped at the post by Thabo Mbeki, who basically succeeded Mr. Mandela. Cyril is also, you may note, a stockholder, or at least on the board of directors of Lonmin, the mining company, which was involved in that tragic and unfortunate shooting down of miners in South Africa in August of this year, which many may come to see as a turning point in the history of South Africa itself. So he is now the deputy, and I guess you could say that he is favored to succeed Mr. Zuma once Mr. Zuma runs for re-election in a year or so, which means Cyril would be tipped to become the state president of South Africa, I guess, around 2018, 2019.
And sticking to the African continent, an update on Mali. We discussed last week that the prime minister resigned, was arrested. What has happened in that week since we chatted about that?
Well, just to provide a bit more context, which we probably should have provided earlier, it's clear that major human rights violations are taking place in northern Mali as a result of the ascension to power of these conservative religious radicals who term themselves to be Islamists and are reputed to be tied to Al-Qaeda. At the same time, there is this slow-motion intervention taking place, spearheaded by France. Now, I just read that it's not expected to be launched until August or September of next year, which is very curious. I think that there is concern that any military intervention could really not defeat these radicals militarily. Certainly, it would lead to even more severe displacement. We know that as a result of their coming to power in northern Mali, you have thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, of refugees from that area that have streamed into neighboring countries, basically helping to weaken the fabric of neighboring countries. You have thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, of internally displaced persons, that is to say people who have moved from northern Mali into the capital, Bamako, which has strained the seams of that already bedeviled city. And that should also add that there's another factor, which is that the African Union is much more resentful and unsympathetic to the idea of a military intervention in northern Mali than the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. It has been said by some of my friends and comrades who followed this region very closely and carefully that ECOWAS is basically now being dominated by the president of Nigeria, Goodluck Jonathan, and Mr. Ouattara, who was placed into power in Cote d'Ivoire by French paratroopers, and that is resented by many leaders of the African Union, particularly Algeria. Algeria, as you know, opposed the NATO intervention in neighboring Libya. Algeria is now housing some members of the Gaddafi family. Algeria has a long history going back to its days of independence, preceding and following independence in 1962, of being hostile to France and France's interests in Africa. And Algeria reportedly and reputedly is very concerned about a French-led intervention so close to its neighborhood. So there you have it. The bottom line is that the suffering continues in northern Mali, but it's unclear what's going to be done to alleviate it. Certainly, the slow-motion intervention spearheaded by France and ECOWAS has met roadblocks, and as noted, presumably will not be launched before September, August 2013.
Gerald, is there any possibility that this could still be an African-led intervention, or is it because intervention, not necessarily militarily, right, in any form, negotiation, whatnot, without having to involve France, or is it because the AU is resisted to that it doesn't leave ECOWAS any choice but to kind of deal with this with France?
Well, just to clarify, Blaise Compaoré, mm-hmm. the leader of Burkina Faso, who you may recall, came to power some years ago by toppling his comrade, Thomas Sankara, mm-hmm. has been negotiating on behalf of ECOWAS with the rebels in northern Mali. If there is an intervention, the troops will be overwhelmingly from ECOWAS, probably overwhelmingly from Nigeria. However, there will be logistics and reconnaissance from France and the United States, and that's what's making a number of people nervous. I think we're still enduring the fallout from the Libyan intervention when many in the African Union, indeed many in the international community, feel that NATO overstepped the boundaries of United Nations Resolution of March 2011, which supposedly was to protect civilians, and basically engaged in regime change. And so people are very nervous that NATO doesn't keep its word. You can't trust these guys. And so they say they're just going to be doing reconnaissance logistics, but I don't know. There's nervousness about that. So I think that's really the stumbling block. I do think that it's apparent that it will be overwhelmingly African troops involved.
And I guess rightfully so hesitant. Now moving on to Egypt, this weekend on Saturday, half the country voted on the referendum. The other half is expected to vote in 2 weeks, I think. either this weekend or next weekend. What is the update there? And how did that, because we talked about last week how the opposition was talking about boycotting or voting no, what ended up kind of taking place over the weekend?
Well, it does seem that there was no boycott, yet the referendum passed by a comfortable margin, approximately 56% voted in favor of it. However, those voting in the urban centers, such as Cairo and Alexandria, voted disproportionately against that referendum, which bespeaks the fact that left and progressive forces are significantly headquartered in Cairo and Alexandria. But Egypt is a country of 80-plus million, and those 80-plus millions are not all living in Cairo and Alexandria, and there is the rub. I think that it's apparent that Mr. Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood comrades are steaming ahead. It's also apparent that his opponents, which includes not only the secularists and feminists and Coptic Christians and many trade unions, are very much concerned that this constitution is basically a manifesto for helping to create, if not some sort of Islamist state, certainly a state where it would be difficult, for example, for feminists to survive in particular. So we shall see what happens, but I think the long and the short of it is that you can score one for President Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood thus far. There you have it.
And moving on to Syria now, an update on there. You would think from reading the Western press that the NBC news correspondent was, the center of this conflict. But apparently there's other stuff going on.
Well, I heard an interview with Robert Baer. He's a former U.S. CIA agent and also a writer. You may be familiar with one of his memoirs that led to the Hollywood movie Syriana with George Clooney, which, by the way, Baer says bears no resemblance to what he did while he was in that region. In any case, in his interview, he says that the mainstream press is overstating the instability of the Damascus regime of President al-Assad. He notes that for some time now, the toppling of that regime has been predicted, actually going back to last year, but it has not fallen as of yet. You may also note that the vice president of Syria, under President al-Assad, basically said that he didn't feel that the regime could defeat the rebels militarily, nor vice versa, which basically argues for some sort of political solution, but the political solution is blocked by the fact that the hegemonic rebels feel that they should not have any dialogue with the al-Assad regime, that their demand is that he must go. As they say in the United States, he must leave either vertically or horizontally, but he must go. And that has led to a stalemate. But I think that the longer that this stalemate lasts, the more dangerous that it becomes. The danger is already occurring. You may have noted the conflict has spread to the Palestinian community in Syria. You would think that they've suffered enough being in exile, but they're getting it basically from both sides, from the regime and the rebels. You may have noted that the conflict has spread into neighboring Lebanon, which is always a very sensitive point, has always, or at least for the last half century or more, been subjected to sectarian tensions between various confessional groups, that is to say, between Christians and Muslims, and then within Muslims, between Shia and Sunni. So this conflict is basically a burning ember right now that bids fair to ignite into a blazing conflagration that would consume the entire region. I would hope that Washington and Ottawa and their NATO allies would adopt a much more rational position with regard to Syria. Right now, in a sense, they're clamoring for al-Qaeda-backed forces to come to power because, as we noted last week, they're at the tip of the spear. They're not the whole and the entirety of the rebel force, but certainly they're the most courageous, they're the bravest, they're the ones willing to give up their lives most readily. And as noted, when the U.S. administration sought to slap sanctions on the group that we refer to as al-Nusra, which is thought to be close to al-Qaeda of Iraq, the other rebel forces who are not close to al-Qaeda in Iraq objected rather strenuously because they see these forces as their comrades. So obviously, there's a kind of united front between these anti-Damascus forces, and if these anti-Al-Assad forces come to power, well, then al-Qaeda of Iraq will have a foothold in Syria, and I'm curious to know why Mr. Harper thinks that's a good thing.
We're all curious as to know what Harper's thinking, but we'll move on to Palestine. And we talked last week about the UN resolution. I don't know if it was a resolution, but that recognized the Palestinian state. And so maybe we could talk a bit about what has happened this week, I guess. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas met with the Pope in to thank the Vatican for their support of this UN resolution. But also, what is the implication of this status? We talked a bit last week, but I'm wondering what you think in terms of how this brings this closer to a two-state solution. And is that... is that something that you think should happen? There's a lot of critique, of course, of the two-state solution. So your thoughts on that?
Well, as of today, as of December 2012, I think that it would not be unfair to suggest that what we're heading to is a one-state solution. And that's not necessarily because that's what Mahmoud Abbas wants, although, parenthetically, you may have noted that Khaled Mashal, the leader of Hamas, came into Gaza some days ago and basically said that all of historic Palestine would be reclaimed by Hamas, which implicitly suggests that he is in favor of a one-state solution of a sort. But I think that if this historic Palestine does move towards a one-state solution, that it will be due overwhelmingly to the stubbornness of the Israeli authorities led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who just recently announced that they're building more settlements in eastern Jerusalem, which is a contested area. It's a contested area and is presumed to be a jointly shared capital under the two-state solution. But by building the settlements there, objectively, Mr. Netanyahu is ruling that out. As noted, with the enhanced status of the Palestinians under international law, the possibility is bruited of the Palestinian Authority taking Mr. Netanyahu and his gang to the International Criminal Court to stand trial for their various misdeeds and transgressions. I don't think we should rule that out at all. So basically, Mr. Netanyahu is making a very dangerous wager. His wager is that the North American powers, the United States and Canada in the first place, will be able to save him and his gang from the reach of international law. The problem there is that the balance of forces, the correlation of forces globally is changing to the detriment of the United States in particular and of Canada as well, and in favor of Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and other developing nations who are less sympathetic to Israeli aggression. So it's apparent that in the long term, perhaps even in the short term, the Israelis are playing a very dangerous game. They've made a very unstable wager. And I think it's going to blow up in their faces, but we shall see.
Do you really think that this is a possibility, the ICC? Would they even consider bringing a case against Netanyahu or other Israelis?
Well, I understand your skepticism.
Yeah.
In light of the fact that the ICC seemingly has an obsession about indicting Africans.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Netanyahu resides in a country that's east of Africa, but it's not an African country, and so I guess that means he can escape the jurisdiction of the ICC. But, once again, the balance of forces, the correlation of forces in the world is changing as we speak. And this obsession with indicting African leaders is a direct result of the balance in December 2012 seemingly dominated by NATO and the United States. But will that be the case in December 2014 and December 2015? I don't think so. So it's just like, to bring into play something I know that you're familiar with and that you're an aficionado of, Omeg, it's like playing the stock market. When you invest in a stock, you're not necessarily investing in what it's going to do today. You're investing in what it's going to do tomorrow. That's how the stock is valued. And likewise, with regard to the prospects for a nation, you just can't look at what's happening today in December 2012. You have to factor in how it will be doing in 2014 and 2015. And there's the problem for Mr. Netanyahu, and I might also say there's the problem for Avigdor Lieberman, his foreign minister, who is on the verge of being in prison for various misdeeds, and I might also say is a leading racist who has called for the expulsion of a significant percentage of the Israeli Arab population. And this is also more bad news for the Netanyahu coalition as they gear up for elections in January 2013.
I had my mic off, otherwise you would have heard my robust laughter when you said that I was. I knew the stock markets. I wish I did. I'm still skeptical because in the, now my history will fail me here. The ICC has been around for how long?
Oh, let's see, 5 to 10 years, something like that.
And in that, we haven't seen any change. So in a sense that it's only been Africans that have been indicted, it's only been Africans that have been convicted. Is that likely to change in the next?
Well, Yugoslavia as well.
But that was prior to the ICC.
Leaders of formerly socialist countries as well. That seems to be their obsession. Well, you know, as I said, your skepticism is justified.
Mm-hmm.
At least in the United States, sometimes there's this tactic of bringing lawsuits to tie down your opponent and to
mm-hmm.
harass your opponent,
mm-hmm.
even if you don't feel that you might prevail. It makes your opponent more susceptible to sweet reason. Just the prospect of being indicted can make your opponent more susceptible to sweet reason. So even if Mr. Netanyahu is not convicted and then jailed, I do think that the prospect of an indictment being brought against him could soften him up considerably.
Moving on now to Japan, that just had an election this weekend. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it's very dangerous. If you're interested in having sleepless nights, well, think about what's happening in Northeast Asia right now. Shinzo Abe, reviled Liberal Democratic Party of Japan, who is conservative despite the name of his party, has been reelected. He was prime minister before. He'll be prime minister again. He's a hawk. What gives us sleepless nights is this territorial conflict with China over these uninhabited islands. And he has vowed to stand firm. The Chinese have vowed to stand firm. The Chinese have been sending ships and planes over these deserted islands. The United States is, of course, encouraging Japanese rearmament, which you might recall they also did, along with Britain, in the first few decades of the 20th century, and we know how that turned out. I think it's very dangerous to encourage this militarist trend in Japan. It's dangerous for North America. It's dangerous for China. It's dangerous for Japan. And then there's another factor. The elections in South Korea are coming within days. And the problem there is that there is still considerable animosity in South Korea towards the Japanese right, which, as you know, pummeled and colonized Korea beginning in 1910. And this issue of sexual slavery of Korean women enlisted forcibly into the Japanese military during World War II is a very raw and sore point, understandably, in South Korea, particularly given the positions of Mr. Abe, the incoming prime minister, who's tended to downplay that very sensitive crime. And so then, of course, I haven't even brought up the fact that the North Koreans seem to be ambling along quite nicely in terms of developing their missile technology. You might have noted the test that they had just days ago. So here you have two of the most developed countries in the world, speaking of number two economy, China, number three, Japan, along with rising power, South Korea, all in the same neighborhood, and that's not even to talk about North Korea, which has been launching missiles lately. It seems to be a recipe for Washington to make enormous mischief, and that's what I'm afraid is going to happen.
And we only seem to have 3 minutes left, and we wanted to talk about Venezuela, but also, I think more importantly, well, I don't know. It's up. I'll leave it to you to choose. But the school shootings in Connecticut. So I'll allow you, I guess, to pick one or talk about both of them in 3 minutes.
Well, with regard to Venezuela, the elections showed that even though Hugo Chavez is recovering from surgery for his cancer, that his party still wields significant influence. His party did quite well during these gubernatorial elections in Venezuela, which augurs quite well for the future. It's something to be optimistic about. Now, with regard to the killings that took place in Connecticut at an elementary school by this young man by the name of Adam Lanza, if I can't recall his name, but it's an x-ray on U.S. society. That is to say that, as you know, in the U.S. left, there's this tendency, which to me substitutes for analysis, to basically say, you know, it leaves an impression that the United States is basically a progressive country, but then they got sidetracked and misled by the Democratic Party. And I think that's an overstatement for this former slaveholders' republic that had Jim Crow, apartheid for decades, that made a ritual out of lynching Africans. That is to say, thousands of people would show up in festivals where the star of the show, involuntarily enlisted, would be an African man or woman, would be hung from a tree and then basically dismembered with the parts passed out to the participants. And I think that this shooting is an x-ray of U.S. society. It shows that this was a society that was built upon violence, and the violence continues to inherit in this society. I should also add that gun sales have skyrocketed since Obama got elected, and that similarly, Obama's received more death threats than any other president in U.S. history by an order of magnitude. And this is not to excuse anything Obama has done, but this is just to show what kind of right-wing politics that we have south of the St. Lawrence Seaway, and how many of our friends on the left, they're in denial about that, don't want to come to grips with it. But when you have the shooting of innocents, 6- and 7-year-olds, led to their death, and this is not the first time, and how now people expect this as a regular part of the culture. Something strange and bizarre and perverse is taking place in this United States of America. And I think it would be well if our friends on the left would do an analysis that took into play the complexities of history, of politics, and also of economics, because these gun manufacturers are basically, in the United States, controlled by these Wall Street private equity firms who invest heavily in what are called sin stocks, alcohol, gambling, tobacco, and guns. And many of the unions basically have holdings and investments in the same kinds of stocks in incestuous relations with these private equity firms. And so you have the scandal of teachers being mowed down in their classroom while their unions are investing in guns that are being used to shoot down these members. I mean, there are so many aspects of this Connecticut shooting that beg out, that cry for analysis, but I'm afraid it's not getting it, and I'm afraid that unless it does get it, this kind of massacre that you saw in Connecticut is going to increase even more than it already has, because as you know, this is not the first time, and I doubt if it'll be the last time that it will happen in these United States of America.
And I'm glad you've contextualized it historically like you did, because it seems like the only conversation from the left or from quote-unquote progressive forces is about gun control, which is not to say that it's unimportant, but that you need to examine the culture of violence that, the U.S. and Canada, for that matter, is built on. So thank you for that analysis. We really appreciate it.
Well, let me add one more footnote, if I may.
For sure.
Adam Winkler, who is a law professor at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, and his recent book has pointed out that the movement away from gun control in the United States starts after the squashing of the Black Panther Party. That is to say, when the Africans seemed to be arming, there was a broad consensus in favor of gun control. After the Africans were disarmed, then gun control went out of the window. I think there's a lesson there, too.
That is very interesting. Thanks for that. And also wanted to let you know that the elementary school teachers union is on strike today. Half of the boards that the elementary school union represents, so I guess it's Southern Ontario, or maybe all of Ontario, half of them are on strike today, or was it yesterday, and half will be on, today, and then half will be on strike tomorrow. So that's something that maybe we could talk about next week.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you for joining us again, Dr. Horn, and we'll talk to you next week, hopefully.
I hope so. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Professor Gerald Horn speaking to us here on Regent Radio.